It's the new year, which means new episodes of Does Not Compute are back every week. A big thanks to our first sponsor of the year, Linode. Linode makes it super easy to spin up SSD servers in just a few seconds. Just pick your Linux distribution, how much power you need, and which of their 8 data centers you want your new server to live in. And you're up and running. All servers are billed hourly, and there's a monthly cap on all plans and add-on services. Since you get full control over all your Linode servers, that means you can run just about anything on them, like Docker containers, VPNs, private Git servers, and more. Of course, everything runs on SSD storage and Intel E5 processors over their 40 gigabit network. This is speedy stuff. What's really cool is that Linode now offers 2 gigs of RAM on their base plan, which costs just $10 a month. Head over to linode.com/doesnotcompute to learn more, and when you sign up with the promo code DOESNOTCOMPUTE2017, all one word, they'll give you $20 in account credit.
It's been a couple weeks, Paul, since we chatted like this.
Yeah, we had like 2 weeks off, something like that, I think.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird because that's really the first time I think we've done that.
I think it is. And also,
I'm pretty sure we haven't had a break before.
I don't think we have. But also, I've been traveling a lot, and so we haven't been talking a lot day to day either. So it's kind of like a double break.
Yeah, man. I think we've both been pretty busy. I mean, we both had kind of the job switchover at the end of the year there, and we're both like now building out products where it's pretty much just us doing the thing, which has been very weird for me. I don't know how that's been for you so far.
I've been enjoying it quite a bit so far. It's been teaching me a lot about just how, even though I thought I had a regular schedule, I didn't really, if that makes sense. Because now I'm just by myself and I work by myself all the time. I don't know. It gives me a different perspective on working remotely, because before I was working remotely with other programmers and on a team. And now, granted, I have coworkers, but now it's just me working on the product and it has a very different vibe to it.
Right. Yeah. That's something that I've been working through myself a lot over the last couple of weeks, because NestNotes, it's just me and my co-founder, the CEO of the company, and she's completely non-technical. So really, unless we're specifically working on figuring out, you know, some business use case or whatever, some actual like how should this feature work kind of thing, then there's no real time that I have to be working specifically. So I've kind of actually been reverting a lot to my default schedule, which is kind of working a lot late at night and going to bed at like, you know, 6 a.m. or whatever.
Yeah, I'm exactly in the same boat. My coworkers aren't necessarily technical. So it's really just me and I get to choose when I work. They don't really care. I mean, I was remote before, but I had a certain time that I needed to be around or I was expected to be available. And now there's not. So I find that I tend to work earlier. Like I had the exact opposite. Like when you're going to bed, I'm being productive like early in the morning. So for me, it works out because when they wake up, I've already blasted Slack. It's like I'm talking to myself in the Slack. It's a ghost town of GIFs of things that I'm working on. And then they wake up and they feel like, wow, there's so much progress. You know, he's done so much today, which is good for me, you know, because I'm by myself and I'm able to get rid of distractions and focus. And then they are able to see lots of progress. I don't know. I think it works really well. It's been working well so far.
Yeah, I think the most difficult thing for me, at least so far, it's only been a few weeks at this point, but what's been really tough is that I know if things look good, like I have pretty okay taste as far as user interfaces go and that sort of thing, but I'm really not a designer and I have trouble designing things out, and I have to do a lot of that now because we don't actually have a designer on staff, a UI designer. So that's been a really interesting thing. Actually, what I found myself doing a lot of is just going through and like looking at, oh, you know, Facebook has a certain permissions thing that I remember seeing a few months ago. How does that work? And like going and finding it and just clicking through it and changing my personal settings back and forth a few times and kind of be like, okay, so this is how they solve that problem. Here's how they solve this. Here's what I like about it. Here's what I don't. And then kind of mashing that up into just some kind of functional UI or hopefully functional NEO.
Right. I tend to go to, what's the term for them? Like style guides, pattern guides or something like that, that have been really popular lately. There's all these companies releasing them. And so I tend to go through those and look around to see what kind of interactions I can repurpose, like you said. What's interesting though, is I find that It sounds really weird to say this, but for me, it's so much more meaningful now. So before, I would go through and look at that stuff and be like, oh, that's kind of cool. But now I find that I'm thinking about these things much more in depth, right? Like you said, you're looking at how it works, but also what you like about it, what you don't like about it. You're trying to understand why it was done a certain way. And I think before I was in this position, I was more into taking things at face value. I'll see a cool interaction, be like, oh, that was cool. But I wouldn't really kind of dig down to figure out why it was implemented that way, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm in the same boat where it's like, it's really easy to look at something. Like there have been a few iOS apps. There was that one to-do list kind of one. It's like orange and it had all the swipey gestures and the pinchies and
Clear.
Stuff. Clear. That's the one. Thank you. When that came out, I feel like there was a lot of that where people looked at it and they're like, ooh, this is really neat. But there wasn't necessarily a ton of thinking, at least by most people, a ton of thinking about like why those choices were made and what made them good or bad choices. And so that's something that I'm trying to be really aware of now, just because I kind of don't have that designer safety net at this point in time, where it's like, I'm really trying to think like, does this make sense? Does this make sense for people who maybe are visually impaired or people who just like using the keyboard, or, you know, does this make sense if you take color out of it? All that kind of stuff. I'm trying to spend a lot of time on, which has been really interesting. And I've been enjoying it, but it's definitely a new challenge in a lot of ways.
I like that a lot though, that you're thinking about different colors. What happens if I remove this color, or, you know, the accessibility implications. I think that's amazing. I think that, you know, if you're letting those type of things guide your design, I can't really go wrong. You know, I mean, I think you'll be in a good position and far ahead of many other products that are out there that, you know, where people don't even consider that stuff.
I hope so. I guess we'll find out over the next couple months. I guess another thing that's been really interesting and pretty cool is that since I don't actually have completed designs for a lot of these things, I have some wires that we had Octopus actually do last year. But those are for the most part pretty incomplete. And some things about how we want to approach these problems have changed internally for us, which kind of affects the designs and all that. And so now it's like, I do have this base set of things, but a lot of times the full interaction isn't defined. So like the main object that you create in our system is called a moment. And it's basically just a snapshot of time where you're like, I was here with these people and here are photos. It's, you know, pretty standard stuff. We had a design for that, but not actually a full, here's how it looks and feels when people upload photos. Here's what happens. Here's what triggers this section to expand or collapse, all that kind of stuff. And it's been really cool to kind of be forced to have to figure out those interactions at the same time that I'm figuring out like data models and stuff. It's like, oh, how do I represent this in the database, and how does that translate to something that actually makes sense for a user, even if that's not what it looks like in the database? But I have the full picture available to me, which I feel like is been a pretty big asset, because a lot of times during design, when it's just a designer handing something off to a developer, it's difficult for them, I think, to think through the entire process, just because they don't have to, and it doesn't exist for them. Like they might not have any idea of how these things are actually going to be stored, or, you know, that it's just tough when you don't have the full data model in front of you.
Yeah. I find it's interesting to think about it in terms of almost using, as a developer, using the designs as a crutch, you know, like using that as kind of a springboard into how you're going to implement something. And when you don't have that at all, it's kind of, you're almost paralyzed by choice, you know, because there's so many different ways that you can implement something, and you start Googling, and then this person recommends this way and this person recommends this way, and it's hard to pick. And that's what my, not really struggle, but because it's not really a struggle, it's just one thing that slows me down a little bit, is because I'm really trying to take ownership of things. I'm really trying to pick my battles, you know? So I'll take a long time to figure out what do I need to work on next. And then I'll have to do some research about that. And of course, everyone has opinions on stuff, and then I have to make the decision and all that. So it has been interesting. I think I had the luxury of being able to work with the design that was already kind of put in place. So I'm not having to come up with things from scratch, but there have been a lot of changes. And that's one thing that's been pretty much constant, is just, you know, I think for both of us, since it's early stage, neither of the products have actually launched yet. You know, we're constantly dealing with, I don't mean dealing with in a bad sense, but we're constantly having to deal with changes, like feature changes, or, you know, we'll go and demo the product for someone that it's interested, and they'll come up with a really great idea. And I'm like, oh crap, that's a great idea, and I should implement that. And it usually touches other things, you know? So you kind of have a domino effect of trying to pick your battles.
You mentioned doing a lot of research when you're like, I have to do this thing. I don't know how to do it. What I've actually found myself doing a lot of the last few weeks is just writing about problems that I need to solve. It's like, okay, I need to handle photo and video upload. How do I want to do that? I could do that with Refile. I could do that with Paperclip. I could roll something on my own. What are the pros and cons to each of those? And how do they interact with the rest of the architecture of the app? And just kind of writing like bulleted lists and also paragraphs of things. Just like, hey, here's how this might work. Here are some problems with it. Here are what I think would be really good about this. How could I solve these problems? And I actually just have a document just called research.md in the root of one of my repositories for this now. And it's been really cool. And what's really nice is that now I'm actually able to kind of go back a little bit and figure out what my thought process was for getting to somewhere. So it's almost like a development journal in a way.
I totally stole your idea, and I do the same thing too. It's kind of like you're rubber ducking yourself, walking yourself through problems. And that's been really helpful. And actually, you know what? Being the only technical person in the team I'm working with, I find that it's actually really helpful to rubber duck to people that aren't technical at all, because they have a lot of insight that I wouldn't normally have. And especially our guy, Scott, he works directly with the stores. He's kind of like their advocate in a sense, right? So he'll come to me and say, they really need this, or, you know, this is how they think. He basically understands how our customers think because he spends so much time with them, which has been very helpful. So I'll kind of shop a feature to him or shop an implementation to him or something. And he'll be like, yeah, you know, 3/4 of the stores will say exactly this. And the other quarter will say exactly this. So it's actually been super useful to include them in as much of the process as I can.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the stage with NestNotes where I can start getting feedback from actual users instead of just trying to guess what people are going to want.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah, it's so hard. There are like a million decisions that have to be made for any app that in order to even launch the first version. And it's really tough to try to stay not too opinionated about things and let your users tell you.
Yeah, there's so many things. I have a couple of different milestones in GitHub, and I have a future and like a 1.1 and all that stuff. And there's so many things in the future list that I want to do and I think are great, but I don't have time for it yet. You know, like I said, I'm learning a lot about picking my battles and actually learning, you know, how to prioritize what needs to happen next in this product, which isn't really something I never had to do because all that stuff was almost kind of laid out for me.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of self-project management going on for me as well.
Well, I think before most of the projects that I worked on, especially the Greenfield ones, had a defined start and end date, you know, so I knew when I was starting and I knew when I was ending. And so I was able to plan within a finite timeline, where now there's not really there's not an end, you know? So I'm trying to figure out how long is this going to take me? How long is that going to take me? And then stack that up. So that way I can kind of present that to my other coworkers and say, how does this work for you guys? Essentially, it's just the whole thing has been such an interesting learning experience.
Yeah, it's definitely, I'm trying to figure out how to even put it, but it's just been like, I'm growing kind of in areas that I wasn't necessarily expecting to.
Yeah, this is actually, one thing I just realized was that this is really pushing me to embrace my insecurities as a programmer or as a designer or as a technical person in general, because there's no one else that can do it. You know, there's not another team member where I can say, you know, if I just don't get to this, they'll probably start on it for me. And that doesn't happen. So now I have to, you know, pick something and be like, this has to happen next. I don't know how to do it, but I have to do it because they don't know how to, you know, there's no one else around that can do it.
Yeah, you're the only one who has a chance of being able to do it.
I'm the only one. And the interesting thing is that we've been revamping the onboarding quite a bit after, you know, talking to the lawyer quite a bit more and talking to our tax people quite a bit more. We're having to change up some of the onboarding and some of the documents that are needed for stores to get on the platform. And so actually just before we started recording, I'm about halfway through an integration with DocuSign because stores that come onto the platform, they need to actually sign a document accepting the terms and all that for the marketplace. And to me, at first, that seemed like such a scary thing. I'm like, oh man, this is something that I can't screw up because this has legal implications. But when I started to break down the problem, it was no different than anything else. So really, I was feeling insecure because of, I guess, the quote unquote implications of it, but I've done this type of integration before, you know? So once I started getting into it, my insecurity kind of fell away, but it was like climbing that initial hill was kind of tough.
So what do you think, what's been like the nicest thing about the new arrangement so far?
On a personal level, I think that my coworkers are so understanding. Even my boss, she's the complete opposite of a micromanager. You know, I've always been really good at over communicating anyway, and I think that helps her in that she can kind of trust, or she knows when I'm getting done. She doesn't, if I'm radio silent, you know, I think that would be a different story. But since I'm communicating and sharing images and GIFs and sharing progress, and since I'm giving them direct access to GitHub, you know, they're the ones filing issues. They're the ones looking at milestones and looking at the projects. They've given me complete freedom and complete trust. You know, they completely trust that I'm going to do my best and that I know what's best for the business. You know, that's why they hired me. And it's kind of freeing to have someone trust you that much. It makes me feel like it just gives me more confidence, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That's actually a really interesting point, too, about how you're sending a lot of screenshots and GIFs and that sort of thing through. That's something I've been kind of struggling with a little bit lately, because a lot of the stuff, the way that I'm building this out, our app is just a client server architecture. So we have a single page JavaScript app that is just talking to a Rails API. And it's like a lot of times I'll work for a day or two on just API stuff. And it's like, what am I going to, there's not a whole lot I can send through. So it's like, yep, I hooked up a bunch of stuff yesterday and it's like, just some code, nothing for you to look at really. So that's been kind of weird.
I guess it's different from person to person, but I think that, you know, Lindsay and Scott, they both appreciate when I share things that they don't quite understand, or they at least want to know. So something that I'll do is I'll send like a code snippet and kind of say, hey, this is generally, like in general, this is what this thing does. And I think I've gotten a lot of really good feedback, or, you know, interactions from them because of that. They'll ask questions and I don't know, it's interesting. So I know that, like, you know, like I said, people are different. So some clients could care less about any of that. They just want it done. You know, they're like, I don't care how you do it. I just want it to be done. But I think I'm also lucky in that sense where both my coworkers are like, I don't have any idea what you do, but I'm happy to learn about it.
Yeah, that's definitely the best attitude.
And I think it's kind of similar to your research document. The more I kind of share little snippets and talk about it, the better I understand what I'm doing. So it helps me either way. And it's also nice to wake up in the morning. I can scroll back through Slack and see what I did the previous day, because there's not that much chatter going on. I can, you know, it's all scrollable. So it's pretty nifty.
Sure.
You mentioned the server client architecture, and that's something that right now Design Collective isn't completely split up. It's kind of half and half. It's like a hybrid, which is strange. There's a bunch of server rendered pages and there's a bunch of view pages essentially. So one of the interesting challenges has been, eventually I know that I want it to be separated, client, you know, server, API, and all that stuff. So I'm slowly, as I work, all the new stuff is all just view apps, essentially, like little mini view apps that run on different pages. So I was pretty happy with how the onboarding is turning out, because essentially what it was is it was a few view components, and there was a step variable. And so when the step variable was incremented, it would switch out views. And so I ended up rewriting a lot of it from scratch, and I'm using view router, and it feels so smooth. And that whole view, actually, you know, it connects to Stripe. There's a whole OAuth process there. And then it also connects with the DocuSign thing that I mentioned. And there's a whole process there, and it's working out really well. So I'm sure I'll have a lot of insight pretty soon about, you know, working on not really like a legacy app, but an app that's already existing and pushing it towards the client server model.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty cool. So you mentioned you're using Vue Router for that. Are you using that just like in hashbang mode then, I assume?
Nope. So I have in the Rails routes, I have a splat for that. So the URL would be like /join and then /join splat. And then that just gets sent straight to the router, and then the router boots it up. So the interesting thing there is SEO, right? Because obviously Google and all that stuff is fine, but then right now it's not a problem because people aren't going to be sharing onboarding. You know, they're not going to post like /join on Facebook because you have to have created a store account to do that. But I think coming up, I think that's probably going to be one of the most difficult challenges to solve, because I'm going to have to figure out, you know, obviously the server rendered stuff is going to be fine, but how do I pick and choose when I need to pre-render something, essentially?
Right. Yeah, that's going to be weird, I guess, especially since it's kind of a hybrid app. Thankfully, with Nest Notes, what I'm doing so far is just using Netlify for the front end. And I haven't messed with it enough to really say I can recommend it at this point, but so far it's been pretty great. So it does the pre-rendering, and it's all CDN backed and that sort of thing. And real easy to deploy is just kind of Heroku style, where you can just push up and it'll automatically detect stuff.
I didn't know that Netlify did all that stuff, the pre-rendering.
Yeah. Yep, it's pretty spiffy.
That's interesting. I might have to check it out pretty soon.
Yep. So I would have to. I can give a tentative recommendation on that, I guess.
A tentative recommendation. That's about as solid as a recommendation as you can get, almost, from a developer.
Yeah.
Like, when a developer answers something mediocrely, you know it's probably good. And when they're enthusiastic about something, you're probably a little bit on edge about it. You know, not sure if you want to believe it. And then when someone is, like a developer, is really kind of down on something, you kind of know that it's either mediocre or real terrible,
mm-hmm.
in my experience anyway.
So speaking of things that developers get really excited about, you mentioned to me earlier today that there is a new major release of the Vue DevTools out, I believe.
Yeah, I don't know if it's major, but it's, maybe. It's kind of like a visual refresh. They tighten up the white space a lot, which is something I've been wanting on my little old MacBook. And I think the coolest thing, or the thing that I like the most about it, is that they added an events tab. So if you're not familiar with the Vue DevTools or the React DevTools, are pretty similar in function, not in aesthetics. But you can basically look at all your components and inspect all the data. And then if you're using Vuex, you can time travel debug, so you can record your Vuex actions and then step forward and backwards. And now they added an events tab, which is great because most of the apps that I work on, or at least the two apps that I work on heavily right now that are Vue-based, neither of them use Vuex. I do use events heavily. So instead of passing callbacks around, so instead of passing, you know, step is finished, here's a function that you should call when you're done. Instead, I use events, and I just broadcast events. And so they added that events tab, and that basically just records all your events, so you can see when your custom events are fired, and you can see any payload data that are sent with the events.
That'll be really nice for me, too, because I am using Vuex in the Nest Notes front end, but I also use events pretty heavily for various things.
Oh, yeah.
So that'll be really cool.
It's perfect. And one thing it does, too, is it shows lifecycle hooks as well for components. So you can see when components are booted and ready and all that stuff. But also, as a side effect, you can use it for performance tuning, because if you're getting a mass load of events coming through, you know, you should probably check to see how many times your components are getting recompiled. Because if you're just tossing data and changing it every time, you know, your components are re-rendering every time, which isn't great. So it has an added benefit of letting you know when things are going nuts and you should probably pare it down a bit.
Yeah, that's really neat. I've been getting way more into the Vue DevTools recently. I hadn't used them up until like a week or two ago much. And so now I'm really learning to kind of rely on those a bit more. And they are pretty great. So I'm looking forward to playing with this new version.
I think the DevTools are one of the underrated things about Vue. I've reused React's DevTools, and they're okay, but Vue is a whole nother level, I think. The Vue DevTools are great, and they're not, I don't know, I've never had a problem with them. If you're using Vue and you haven't checked out the Vue DevTools, you're making a mistake, and you need to go check them out.
Thanks again to our sponsor for today's episode, Linode. Anyone looking to spin up virtual servers should definitely check Linode out. You can deploy speedy SSD servers in just seconds across any of their 8 data centers. Plans start at only $10 a month, and for that price, you actually get a server with 2 gigabytes of RAM, which is a super good deal. Even better, if you go to linode.com/doesnotcompute and sign up with the promo code doesnotcompute2017, they'll give you $20 in account credit to get started. Go check out Linode today. So it's a different year now than the last time we did this, Sean.
It is a different year. It is. 2 days ago, I was telling someone that we should move to the start date system, where each day is just an absolute date.
Does anybody understand how that works, though? I feel like even within Star Trek, it kind of tends to be different. It's almost just like a random number.
I'd be okay with that, too. I don't know. I read a blog post. Maybe I can find it. Many, many moons ago, that talked a lot about it. I thought it was interesting.